I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. If chocolate is your passion, then get thyself to Las Vegas. Swim in chocolate pools, wash in chocolate fountains. Okay, so I'm exaggerating a little, but you get the idea. Then what makes a true French baguette? The crackling crust, a perfect crumb, light and textured insides. Today, you'll meet the doctor of bread. Also, sparkling wines you didn't know about, and Belgian beers. But first, let's see what's in season at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with a market report. We're visiting today on this beautiful sunny day here at the Farmers Market with Christina Kelso, who comes in from Thermal, California. It's a date ranch for Flying Disc Ranch. And she today has, of course, her usual array of dates, but she's also proudly displaying an award that they just won at the Riverside County Fair at the National Date Festival. And they won a citrus award. Citrus also grows well out in the hot desert. And Christina, first of all, let's talk about the two kinds of citrus you're selling. Let's start with those amazing oranges.
Right. Those are called the Royal Mandarin, formerly called the Temple Orange. It's really great because it juices easily. It gives up its juice like nothing else, and they're super sweet. People tend not to grow them because they separate easily. The juice separates. The pulp falls to the bottom. But you stir it up, it's a delicious juice. It's just commercial juicers won't
okay,
use it,
and so. A mandarin we normally associate out here with something like a tangerine, but this is a mandarin. This is an orange.
Yeah, it's Temple Orange or Royal Mandarin.
Sort of rebranded
exactly
for the West Coast.
Exactly.
And very, very juicy. And then you've got the pink flushed grapefruit.
Yes.
And those are called the ruby.
Mm-hmm.
And how long are you going to have the grapefruits and the temple oranges, the mandarins?
We will have them probably almost to May.
Okay, great. And this is just really, really super sweet desert citrus fruit.
Yes, I have to say that I love the dates, but the grapefruits are why I moved to the farm. I fell in love with them. They are really good.
Right, and actually delicious. Sweet and very edible, even for people who might think grapefruits are sour.
Ours are really sweet. I eat them like an orange. That's how I suggest. Just cut them into segments and enjoy them. Or they make a great juice, too.
Primarily Robert Lauer, who is the farmer,
yes.
Is it primarily a date farmer. So tell us what kind of dates you have.
Sure. We've got a number of varieties, about 12 altogether. But our main ones would be the Medjool, the Jerry, the Barhi, and Deglet Norris.
And, you know, we do have three date people here, and date growers are all in one area. They have to be out in the desert, and all the dates are different at every stand.
They are.
Completely different.
Because it's the way we do permaculture, so we think it sets just the flavor and how much we get off of each tree. We have really healthy trees. We get up to 100 pounds per cluster. There could be 18 clusters on a tree, so that gives you an idea of just how much abundance we enjoy, and we think it's because of our growing techniques.
Mm-hmm. And briefly, what is permaculture?
Permaculture, it's really working with nature and trying to, you know, just, we have like a living mulch year-round. Just so basically all we give the dates are, you know, water, sunshine, compost, and that's it. Yeah, and we always invite people to visit, so.
Visit the farm, too, and also visit, and taste the dates, too, because you will find a great deal of difference in the flavors. There are people that just swear by your dates. They have to have your dates and nobody else's. And now, you come to the Wednesday Farmers Market now every other week.
We sell the blossoms, the fresh female date blossoms, so that's coming up, and we'll be here every week for maybe the, you know, not starting next week, but the week after.
Okay, and the blossoms are not edible, but they're beautiful, and a lot of people like to take them home as decorations.
They do. I think we're the only ones who have them.
Yeah, they do. They're stunningly big, wild, I don't know, orchids or something. Yeah, they're beautiful.
Yeah, check them out.
That was Christina Kelso. She works with Robert Lauer out at Flying Disc Ranch from Thermal. They are date farmers, and they are also award-winning citrus farmers, and you got to check out their ruby grapefruit and their temple oranges, which are also called royal mandarins. Very, very sweet and very juicy. We have managed to catch up with Mark Peel, who, of course, is the owner chef at Campanile. So, Mark, what are you going to be cooking with this week?
Well, let's see. I think we're kind of edging into spring, and the English peas are coming out. I love English peas, but you have to get them when they're small. When they're overgrown, they're like little potatoes. They're not so good. And I like them better than the sugar snaps. Sugar snaps are very sweet, but I think they're one-dimensional in flavor. That's my opinion. I'm sorry. English peas, you shell them. And then you just throw them in a pot, blanch them with a little bit of onion, a little bit of garlic, some potatoes. And when it's all tender, just puree it. You may pass it through a coarse sieve, season it, and you have soup. It's vegetarian, it's vegan, delicious.
So it's a new twist on like a split pea on a pea soup. It's a thick soup.
It comes out a little bit thick, yeah, depending on how much potato you put in there. You put in enough potato, it can be really rich and delicious. Beautiful color, too.
And you add water and not any kind of stock?
Just water.
Okay, so the proportion then of, let's say, like a pound of peas, a quart of water.
If you're making it for four people, I think it's better to make it for eight, because when you make soup, you might as well make a big quantity. I would say at least a pound, pound and a half of peas, about 8 ounces, half a pound of potatoes, and then a half a pound of everything else. Onions, a little garlic, maybe a little bit of carrot. But, of course, the peas have to predominate.
Okay.
That's what the flavor is.
All right, and how do you tell? I mean, the pea pod is pretty puffy. And how do you actually don't know until you open the pod if the pea is too big or not?
Well, if the pea pod is almost round, that's overgrown.
You
can sense.
You can sense.
No, you can sense. You look at it and you feel the force. So you can feel of how good the peas are. And then, of course, you can just open it up and taste one.
Okay, now a pound of peas, you have to buy 2 pounds of peas to get a pound of peas, right?
At least, maybe 2.5 pounds.
Okay.
But what else are you going to do sitting there watching television? You might as well shell peas.
Dancing with the Stars, peas, goes together, right? Yeah, you know, the snap peas and the English peas tend to be sold side by side, and some people confuse them. How do you identify them readily, which is which?
The sugar snaps are firmer, brighter green, and you can eat the whole thing, and they're sweet. The English peas is a thinner shell, a little more leathery. You can't eat the outside. It's too tough.
Okay, great. And they're going to be coming on fresh real soon at the markets, and that's a super simple recipe. That was Mark Peel. He is the chef owner of Campanile, and he is here every single week, and he's all excited about the English peas, and he just gave us a wonderful, simple soup recipe, which anybody can make. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
If you're planning on going to the Hollywood Farmers Market tomorrow morning, the hours have been shifted for the LA Marathon. For tomorrow only, the market is open from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. The market, of course, is located at Ivar and Selma in Hollywood, and there's an hour of free parking in the Arclight parking lot. I also wanted to announce the winner of our Good Food Sweepstakes. We were giving away a beautiful copper skillet last month to supporters of the show, and I'm happy to let you know that Noelle Miranda of LA will be receiving this amazing piece of equipment from KCRW. Thanks so much to all of you who subscribed during our 2 days of pledge drives. What do you think you could tell about a person from looking at their grocery lists? I don't know. I'm afraid it might be a little too much. There's a woman who's been collecting found lists. Besides the awful spelling, you might be horrified at what these lists tell us about us as a people. That's coming up next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Hillary Carlip is a very interesting woman. She has been saving people's discarded shopping lists since she was an adolescent. She creates these elaborate fantasies about what the shopping list reveals about this person. And she's here with me in the studio. Her new book is A La Carte, The Secret Lives of Grocery Shoppers. Hi, Hillary.
Hi.
Do you remember the first list you found?
I actually do. I do. It was in New York in front of the Red Apple Market. And it had dental floss and then all these items like licorice and peanut brittle and all these like teeth challenging items. So the dental floss seemed to really fit.
Did you immediately start saving those? Like, did you save that one?
Immediately.
Why? What was it about the list?
I just found them so fascinating and felt like when I saw that, I right away pictured who I thought lost that list or left it behind. And the more I collected them and the more I looked at the handwriting, the items being bought, the types of paper written on, to me, they've become like memoirs, like so revealing and really tell so much about a person.
Let's run down a few of your favorite lists just to give people a flavor of what we're talking about. One list that I love begins with a lot of extremely healthy things, power bars.
Yes, Deb. Yes. Power bars, there's protein powder, all sorts of things.
There's Splenda, there's soy milk on it, and then it ends with...
Chips Ahoy. Right. Come on.
I love it. I love it. It's like the struggle.
Exactly. Doesn't that just say so much right there?
Oh, it does. It does. And then another one I really love, perhaps for a lactose intolerant person.
Oh, yes. Estelle. It's whole milk, heavy cream, ice cream, string cheese, and then gas X with 3 exclamation points. Yes, indeed.
Did you ever have occasion to actually meet a person?
Well, the book, which we haven't said yet, is made up of these found lists and then me portraying the person I think lost their list and photographed in markets as these people. So I've never met the actual person. It's only been my imagination.
And the lists that are pictured in the book, are they the actual lists?
Actual lists.
Oh, my God. It's so amazing. Okay. I'm looking at June's list.
Yes.
Give us an idea of what's on her list and the thing that seems like it doesn't fit on any list.
Okay. Well, to me, of course, it said June is having a party. There's ice cream. There's paper plates, cups, and plasticware, and pop, which I always love. Not Coke, not soda, but pop. So that, to me, informs me more so what kind of a woman I think June is. But then we get down to number 12, and there's Newt.
N-E-W-T.
Newt. Yes.
So she needs a volleyball. She needs to go to Radio Shack for something. And then she also needs to go buy a newt.
Right. And then after that is number 13 is book on newt. And it goes on. She needs rock tree branch and filter materials and et cetera. So.
Oh, how marvelous.
Jim, but you know, we haven't yet mentioned, I think, my favorite list of all, which is Derek. And this list.
Oh, this is the really sort of scary list.
Yes. Okay. Mouse traps, cheese, mouse. Yes. Found that list. Just as is.
That's
right?
Really frightening.
It is. Oh, this is a good one too. Lloyd.
Tell me what you think about Lloyd. Who do you think
to
Lloyd
me,
is?
It's very shaky handwriting. There's one jar postum. There's prunes. There's TV din, just D-I-N, not even a period. There's toilet paper and a half a chicken. And to me, it just said an older man whose wife passed away probably left that special pad there. You know, that's what she used. So he continued using it and is just buying a few things. Lloyd was really fun for me to shoot in the market because I got to use one of those smart carts, which I always enjoyed.
Now, after experiencing these lists for all of these years, did you find any common threads at all? Or did it more do the opposite, sort of speak to you of how absolutely unique each one of us is?
I would say both. There certainly, every single list is so different and so tells a story that you do see the uniqueness. But also, there are some themes. I would say 90% of people misspell bananas. And there's, you know, some certain kinds of stores also you find certain kinds of lists. So the health food stores or the Whole Foods type of stores are different from the big shopping markets, are different from the ethnic stores. I have several lists in here. One's a Vietnamese list, all in Vietnamese.
Oh, you have to share the Armenian lady.
That was all, to me, that was someone sending this woman shopping, and to me it became a annoying relative, mother-in-law. But this is the list. A fairly good size of veal shanks, if tender, lamb shanks, if not veal, gata, which is Armenian bread, if soft, not hard, bulk bargain sour cherries, if small, ripe, and firm, Lamajun, if fresh, spinach bureg, if frozen. Everyone has an if. It keeps going on with all these ifs.
Oh, what a wonderful thing. Well, I thank you so much for coming in. It's really unique.
Oh, my pleasure.
I loved it. And the book is just really fabulous. Thank you, Hillary.
Thank you so much.
A la carte. The Secret Life of Grocery Shoppers is Hillary Carlip's funny book. It'll crack you up and make you want to shred your lists up before you toss them in the trash. Actually, if you want to bear it all, email me your lists, unedited, then I'll put them online for us to all check out. scan them, then email them. That would be even better. One thing you can't get at a grocery store is a sublime French baguette. This bread has been made badly by so, so many. There's an American who's done a lot to change the state of the baguette, even in France, especially in France. He's a doctor, and he's here to help. I'll be right back with him next on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Sometimes what it takes is a really, really smart American from Brooklyn to show the French where they've gone wrong. Dr. Stephen Kaplan has probably written the most exhaustive history of the culture and traditions of French bread. In fact, he's the man who made the French bakers realize that what they were producing in the 80s and 90s was nothing more than the French version of Wonder Bread. He's a fabulously interesting man, and I'm so happy we get to spend the morning with him. I want you to take us to the period in time in which you sort of started popping up in French pop cultural, the arena, television, different sorts of interviews where you started saying to the French, your bread is not what it was. Yeah. But in stronger terms.
Yeah. That goes back to about 1990. It was a very complicated thing to do. As the French say, I don't spit in the soup. I'm a guest of the French. I spend a lot of time there. It's a culture that attracts me. I characterize myself as a critical Francophile. Bread is the French patrimony. It's French identity. It's French culture. And it was very hard for me as an American.
But you must have been so sad, and you had all this knowledge.
I'd been following bread for a long time. I'd been writing about it extensively, but mostly in the 18th century. But all the while, almost every day, I would visit more than one bakery, and I would assess. And my assessments were increasingly dire. And it was clear to me that bread was not very good.
Now, why was this? What had happened in the post-war period that had so completely changed what the baguette was meant to be?
That's the crucial question, and the answer is relatively simple. The French were deeply jolted by the war, devastated by the war. During the war and the occupation, they ate what they called a pain de caca, a caca bread. It was dark. It was coarse. It was made with products that you normally don't put in bread, wood chips, potato, what have you. Emerging from the war with the liberation, they hoped to rediscover the bread that they had always known to be consubstantial with their very sense of existence. And then a series of accidents occurred. And to be economic in my narrative, by accident, a baker discovered a way in which to produce white bread from flour that was not really very white flour. It was by a process that we call intensive kneading. It was kneading at 3 or 4 times the speed of regular kneading, and it was kneading for a much longer period of time. This oxidized the bread. The bread contained additives including fava bean flour, and the fava contains an enzyme which, when it's oxidized, also moves towards making bread very white. So they're able to produce, with the same mediocre flour, suddenly a bread that had immense volume and that had extreme whiteness. And it seemed to be like discovering the philosopher's stone. And overnight, this is 1955, 1956, virtually every one of the 55,000 bakers in France began to adopt what we call the white bread intensified kneading process. And the good news was it was white and it was voluminous. It looked good. It was reassuring psychologically. It seemed to say, we're finally over the war. The bad news was it was utterly insipid, devoid of taste and devoid of its soul. The soul of bread is its aromatic constitution. This was bread that had no odor whatsoever.
It was the French version of white bread.
It was the French version of white bread. And the Bakers invested heavily in renewing their equipment in order to make this bread. They were pushed by the manufacturers of machines. They were given low interest loans. They were encouraged by the government to modernize and
but
to mechanize.
But what about all these mills, these tens of thousands of French mills?
The mills were increasingly reduced in number by concentration with the big guys phagocyting the little guys. So today we have 500 mills in France.
Amazing.
500, huh? That's not very many.
Who was the key figure that sort of really was able to first open up and who made the step to change?
I would say it was a group of a generation of bakers who are today between 40 and 50 years old. It was these younger bakers who began to say, you know, you're right, there's something wrong with our bread. Let's rethink what we're doing. And the culmination was, in this is typically French because the state stepped in, was an edict called the Bread Edict of 1993, which was a law that said that to call a bread of tradition, you must bake it without using any additives, any enhancers, any taste exhausters, any emulsifiers, any of this garbage that you find long lists of in most bread, and you cannot freeze it. So when bakers are confronted with the fact that they can't freeze and they can't use the crutch of chemicals, they have to go back to the old technique. And the old technique is basically called fermentation.
What intrigues me is this period of time that you were working in France and creating this awareness was also the period of time here in the United States that young chefs who loved bread started leaving the hot kitchen and becoming intrigued by bread. And we started to see Acme Bakery up north and down here, of course, La Brea Bakery. What are some breads that you love?
Well, I think that the breads I see in America that are interesting are breads being made largely by small bakers in enterprises where they're putting out maybe 800, 1,000 pieces a day. And they're using four elemental ingredients. They're using water, they're using flour, they're using a little bit of salt, and they're using an agent of fermentation, and that's it.
Do you feel comfortable giving me some names?
Well, you know, I've done a lot of tasting, and I want to be positive. And I think a lot of the bakeries that are putting out bread now lack maturity and lack experience, and I think at this juncture, I have to say, go for it. But I think that, you know, Bread Bar in L.A. is, for me, the most interesting experiment because it's the most authentic, it's the most rigorous, it's the most inventive. There are certainly other people out there as well. We see more and more French bakers coming over. But I see kids coming out of Franklin and Wales and other universities that are devoted to bread making who have passion. That's the first absolute obligation. And who have manual skills. You have to be smart in the head and smart in the hands. And you've got to treat bread the way you treat wine. That is to say, you have to take it seriously. You have to taste it and not simply put it in your mouth. You have to make distinctions. You have to look at the fundamental characteristics of appearance, of crust, of crumb, of mouthfeel, of aroma, and of taste. And on those grounds, we can have a conversation.
Dr. Stephen Kaplan is a Cornell University history professor and the world's preeminent bread scholar. Good Bread is back. Contemporary History of French Bread, The Way It Is Made and the People Who Make It is Dr. Kaplan's book. I've got links to some articles about Stephen Kaplan and some places to taste bread aspiring to perfection. Of course, there's more to French food than just bread. I'll be back on Good Food with stories of French country cooking. Stay tuned. Every once in a while, life circumstances changes one's, well, entire life. Ann Willen, noted cooking teacher who for years has been installed at the Chateau de Fay in Burgundy, teaching at her famous school, La Varenne, has recently made the decision to sell the chateau and move to Santa Monica. We're talking to her this morning about country life in France and her new book, The Country Cooking of France. Hi, Anne.
Hi, Evan. It's good to see you.
It's wonderful to see you. And I understand you have now become a full-time resident of Santa Monica.
As of a month ago, yes. We're just delighted.
Which means giving up this amazing chateau that you had in Burgundy, the Chateau de Fay.
Yes, we moved in 25 years ago. We fell in love with it. We'd no idea what we were going to be doing. And it became a whole way of life.
So during the process of making this new book, The Country Cooking of France, which I must say is like, it's like revisiting just the greatest hits of old friends, this book. It's quite beautiful. It must have been a way for you to look back at everything you managed to imbibe during those 25 years.
Well, certainly people ask me how long it took to write, and literally to write. It was about 3 years. But indeed, it's the people that we've met over the years, the parts of France that we've visited, the changes we've seen. A lot of changes in country cooking, though in many ways it hasn't changed at all.
Talk about that.
People eat differently, lighter, more salads, much wider range of ingredients, even a little bit of ethnic food. But the market, there's wonderful, it's a covered market, dates back to, 150 years probably, right near us. And in the time we've been there, from it being really purely local stuff, there's now, from the Massif Central, there's a sausage cellar, dried sausages and cheese. There's a Provençal and Mediterranean dried chickpeas, all of that, spices, and lots of olives. The cheese people have grown from a couple of good stands. And there's a Chinese spice lady with Asian spices.
Now, Anne, pick one or two recipes for me that in your mind just sing of what the essence of French country life is for you.
Coq au vin.
That's so interesting. I was just thinking about coq au vin the other night. Now, coq au vin, some people hear that and they think, oh, chicken and red wine. Disabuse them of that notion.
Well, coq au vin can start very simply by simmering a chicken cut up just simply in some wine, not bothering with marinating it, not bothering to go out and get the world's greatest chicken. You can even do chicken thighs, whatever you want. But you're going to add character instantly by the wine. So in Burgundy, it's going to be Pinot Noir, not an expensive Pinot Noir, but it's going to be therefore slightly fruity, not too heavy. Go down to Provence and you're going to get the Shiraz, that very rich, high alcohol, going to taste much more robust. Go over to Alsace and you might make it with white wine instead of red.
Is it always a chicken or is it sometimes a rooster?
Well, if you are lucky and you're a strong hand, it's a rooster. And we, for example, can order roosters in the market. You need a butcher's hand and a very sharp knife and a cleaver to cut up an old rooster. And then the flavour is amazing. Chinatown's the place to go.
So it has this amazing deep flavour and it also allows you to cook it longer without it falling apart.
And then it really does need marinating beforehand. So 2-3 days marinating tenderizes it, adds flavour right it sort of down near the bones. And indeed, a rooster can take 2 or 3 hours. Really slow simmering, not even simmering, poaching in a low oven.
Now, what about a dessert? Tell me something you would love to cook from the Santa Monica Farmers Market, for example.
I have to pick up something I read this morning. Very French, New York Times. There's Mark Bittman suggesting clafoutis, which is batter pudding with clementines.
Oh, what a great
Delicious.
Idea.
Isn't that a great idea?
That's a great idea.
Just divide them up.
Now, you say batter pudding, clat frit.
Yes.
Describe what that is.
It's pancake batter, fairly substantial crepe batter, doesn't have a raising agent like American pancakes, and you put your fruit into any size of baking dish, just butter it a bit, and you spread your fruit in it, seasonal fruit, cherries with the pits, a traditional, but prunes would be very traditional, apples at this time of year in France. You make your batter, flour, eggs, milk. It wants to be a layer, I would say, about an inch thick of batter. Bake it. I like it to get really dark and caramelized. I sprinkle some sugar on the top, a bit of sugar in the batter. When it comes out, you spoon over a couple of spoons of rum or kirsch, just something, and you get that waft of alcohol, and you take it to the table.
It's like the most extreme, beautiful version of a Dutch baby. Some people think of a Dutch baby as that same kind of pancake. It's so beautiful. We don't make this enough.
Not enough, and it's good food for this time of year.
It's even wonderful for breakfast.
Great. Brunch.
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 And what a beautiful thing to have you here so we can have more of you face to face.
Evan, it's such a pleasure always to talk to you.
Thank you very much. The Country Cooking of France is Anne Willen's latest book. Her new home is Santa Monica, and you may run into her at the area farmers markets. I'll have a recipe from her book on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Belgium neighbors France, and it's a place where beer making goes back to the monks in the Middle Ages. It's actually some of my favorite type of beer. There's a festival celebrating Belgian beers that ends tomorrow. Hurry and drink up. More on Belgian beers when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. As anyone who's listened to this show for very long certainly knows, I love beer. I love really great brews. So it's with a lot of pleasure that I introduce you to David Farnworth. David has organized the Belgian Beer Festival at Lucky Baldwin's Pub in Pasadena since 1999. Hi, David.
Hiya.
For those who aren't really up to snuff about brews, could you describe for us the difference between what we call a Belgian and other brews?
Well, basically, the main thing is it comes from Belgium, and they've been brewing beer for hundreds of years. One time there was nearly a brewery in every town in Belgium. It was a way for them to make a living, to make money. So it's just the kind of like better brewed, tend to be interesting, such as the fruity ones, slightly higher alcohol normally. They're just so well brewed. And you more drink them like a wine. You don't really drink them like you drink, say, a Budweiser, just down it. You know, the Belgian beers, you kind of like savor it, and you drink it slowly like a good wine.
I happen to love Belgian beers, and I tend to love the really sort of sour flavors. I find them to be very strange, but really intriguing. What are some other flavors that we could see in the Belgians?
Well, you have the, of course, you have the lambic beers, which are the fruity ones, and you get all different fruits. I mean, there's even a pineapple one. So you get the lambic ones, which we get a lady comes into the pub and says, oh, I don't drink beer. Normally, when they have one of the lambic beers, they drink beer. They like it. Yeah,
they're quite good. I mean, they're fruity, but they're not super, super sweet. I mean, they have a bit of a sour edge to them.
Right, especially if there's a brewery called Cantillon. Their lambic beers are really interesting. There's one they do called Rose de Gambinas. This is what is classed as a framboise, which is raspberries. But this is different. There's hardly any sweetness whatsoever. It's tart. It's slightly sour. The first mouthful, when you take it, you think, oh, this is horrible. But when you get into it and drink it a little bit more, you tend to like it.
And these are the kind of beers, because these flavors are so complex, that are really suitable to eating with food, aren't they?
Oh, they are, yes. Yes, especially the lambics. We have them with dessert. And then there's other dishes that we do for the festival, where we put different beers in, depending what the dish is. My favorite is rabbit.
Oh, so you do like a traditional rabbit stew?
We do. Well, we do two. We do a stew, or we do like the meat just marinated for a few days and then cooked. The one that we're doing at the moment is, we call it Lapin à la Maritsu. And Maritsu is what they call an Abbey beer, brewed by Mortgate. They're famous for Duvel. Mm. And we marinate the rabbit for a few days. In, it's two beers we use. It's the Maritsu 8 and the Maritsu 10. One's 8%, one's 10. One's a dark one, and one's like a triple, like a golden color. And I was in Brussels last August. I was in a pub in the Grand Place, and I had it there, and I just loved it. So we recreated it here, and it tastes really good, and it actually sells very well, which is a surprise when you think about it. A lot of people wouldn't like to eat a rabbit.
That's true.
But we do take the tail off.
Tell us once again the dates that the festival is going to run. We'll, of course, also have the information on our website.
Yeah, it goes to the end of the month. I think it's like last Sunday, which is like March the 2nd, if you know what I mean. But it doesn't just end. We'll continue on for the week or so afterwards, because we don't just take the beers off.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Belgian Beer Festival at Lucky Baldwin's Pub in Pasadena and Sierra Madre ends tomorrow, maybe a few days after tomorrow, too. I've got links at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now it's time to take a bath in molten pools of chocolate and dance in chocolate fountains. Las Vegas is fast becoming the new chocolate city, and it's time to take a trip there. Stay tuned for details. That's coming up in 1 minute, right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. We know that chocoholics will go to many lengths to indulge their obsession. Well, now it appears there's a one-stop shop of nirvana that's a bit surprising. Turns out that Las Vegas could almost be declared a chocolate destination. Lark Ellen Gould is the Pacific and Asia editor for a national travel trade magazine, and she covers Las Vegas on a regular basis for the LA Times travel section, which is where I saw her article on the chocolate boom in Las Vegas. So why did you decide to write about chocolate in Las Vegas at this particular point in time?
Chocolate is seeing a bizarre boom there. I wasn't even aware of it until I started looking around and seeing all these boutique chocolate cafes like Payard Patisserie that opened in November at Caesars. And then there was Jean-Philippe Patisserie, which opened at Bellagio with his 27-foot wall of chocolate sculpture. And it seemed to me that something was going on there, and I started to look more deeply, and I discovered chocolate was being served in flights, tasting flights, as you would wine, and just about every restaurant had some kind of a chocolate fantasy going on there.
Describe this wall of chocolate that you referred to.
At Jean-Philippe Patisserie at Bellagio, there's a wall of chocolate which has tons of chocolate pouring through it in little cups, almost like a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory fantasy, where the chocolate pours down into another cup and another cup and another cup into this creamy liquid, just delicious thing that you want to take a bath
so,
in.
So it's like a fountain, a huge fountain.
Through it in little cups, almost like a Charlie and the Chocolate Factory fantasy, where the chocolate pours down into another cup and another cup and another cup into this creamy liquid, just delicious thing that you want to take a bath
so,
in.
So it's like a fountain, a huge fountain.
It's a huge fountain.
Are you allowed
behind glass.
To?
Behind
glass. Behind glass. So you can't just take a cup and hold it out and fill
no.
it up.
Right.
Too bad. So these chocolate boutiques, are they a combination of sort of all arts of the chocolatier? Are there confections and ice cream and drink? And
yes.
pastry?
Yes, absolutely. Most lounges have several versions of chocolate martinis or chocotinis. And a new restaurant in Henderson or Green Valley, which is a little outside of the Strip, opened up a restaurant called White Chocolate, which really focuses on the dessert but also serves other things.
Describe some of the finer chocolate desserts that you've experienced there. In general, in Las Vegas.
I think Katrina Markoff's Vosges Haute Chocolat Café at the Forum is pretty much tops the list in that she puts really odd flavors together. She mixes different types of chocolates from different areas of the world, whether Ecuador, Ghana, and puts them together with curries and chiles and mangoes and creates these totally new evolution in tastes, I think. And then you also have maybe you might want to call it more pedestrian, but it still really got the chocolate movement going in Vegas a long time ago, Ethel M's, where they have mixed scotch, bourbon, liqueurs in these pieces and really made some momentum. Joël Robuchon has this chocolate cart in which he presents at, after the meal some 27 different creations of chocolate candies and desserts from sticks of mint that are covered in chocolate or sticks of pineapple or orange to his own candies with his imprint as well as creme brulees and different custards. And you just will look at this and you'll have a heart attack because you don't know where to begin.
Can you go there and just have the chocolate cart?
No.
What a shame.
You must go through the 8 or 16 courses ahead of time.
So if you were going to tell us the places that we had to absolutely experience if we were really into chocolate, it would be Paillard.
Paillard.
Which is where? At the Bellagio?
It's at Caesar's Palace.
At Caesar's Palace. Reblochon for the absolute highest end.
Right.
And that is?
At the MGM Grand.
Where else?
I would say that you'd do well at Bellagio with Jean-Philippe Pâtisserie.
And then Vosges. Where is Vosges?
Vosges is at the Forum Shops. And so that's interesting. And then, strangely, Ethel M's has a chocolate lounge at the fashion show where you can have a chocolate party. Or you can just sit there and read a magazine and have hot chocolate and a bunch of bonbons.
I've got a link to Lark Ellen Gould's story on the Las Vegas chocolate scene at kcrw.com/goodfood. Sparkling wines are so much fun to drink. Next on Good Food, a drink of the bubbly stuff with wines you may not have heard about. That's next on Good Food on KCRW and kcrw.com. Just because New Year's Eve is past and the celebration of the holidays is over doesn't mean we should put those sparkling wines away. With us this morning is Stacy Hunt, our wine guru, who comes to us from Duvan Wine and Spirits.
Hi, Stacey.
Hi. I'm here to bring you the latest in fizz.
Many of us already know that something that is not actually grown in the region of Champagne can't be called Champagne.
Except in California.
Really?
Yeah. You know, California is a 600-pound wine gorilla, and it is the only place outside of the Champagne region of France that can call its sparkling wine Champagne.
But a lot of people do that?
No, because here's the interesting thing. Now we get into class. Those sparkling wines who consider themselves having class don't have any intention of calling themselves Champagne. They want to call themselves California sparkling wine. Those wines that are wannabes, maybe, and I'm not saying they don't taste good. I'm just talking about, you know, their personalities. We've all grown up with those kind of people. They stamp Champagne right on their California label.
Oh, that's so funny. There are different types of fizz. So take me through some of these different categories that you want to share.
The first fizz is anything that's effervescent and goes when you hold it up to your ear and just sparkles like crazy as it goes down your throat, kind of lighting up your whole mouth. And we find that primarily in Champagne. And so the finer the bubble, the softer the fizz. The larger the bubble, a little bit more sharper the fizz. The next category after that is sparkling. Sparkling definitely has larger bubbles, so there's always going to be a lot more action in your mouth. And then the next after that is called crémant, and it signifies a wine that has about half the pressure of a normal sparkling wine.
Are there sometimes wines that end up having a little bit of fizz, but it just is sort of a byproduct? Sometimes I've had a young wine, a Pinot Grigio, right out of the barrel, so to speak. And sometimes it has a little bit of an effervescence.
If it's not meant to have effervescence, that means that it's just very young and not ready to be in the bottle. And I've had that happen ordering a bottle of wine even, and you put it in your mouth and you have something going on your tongue. Well, it won't kill you. That's for sure. But it isn't the way it's supposed to be. If it's sparkling, it needs to have some definitive labeling that lets you know that. Otherwise, it's not quite ready.
Take us through some of these sparklers that we should be tasting.
Well, I think it's important to note that some have never been in the United States before this past year, and I think that's why we're not as aware of them. So let's start over in France, and let's start with the Loire Valley. There is a grape that grows there called Chenin Blanc. Very aromatic grape, very delicious grape, has a lot of fruit, finishes dry. And Chenin Blanc is made both as a still wine and a sparkling. And when you find it sparkling, it will be called Vouvray. It's wonderful with raw seafood. Moving over a little bit now to southwestern France, there is the Pêche, which we've talked about before, made by Veuve Amballe. And that is like the fresh white peaches. And this is an unbelievably delicious, you know, sparkler. There's also, moving around the corner in southwestern France, one called the Blanquette des Limoux. This is very much a secret. It's made from a little-known grape called Mauzac, M-A-U-Z-A-C, blended with Chardonnay. And this only comes in magnums. It's its personality. They don't make it in regular-sized bottles. But even in the magnum, it's $32, and a magnum is equivalent to two bottles of wine. And then going around the corner and moving up the Côte d'Or into Burgundy, there is a famous wine there called the Bouillot de Bourgogne. And this is a rosé sparkler made from Pinot Noir. And this is made in the Method Champenoise manner, but only with the Pinot Noir grape. And it's like fresh strawberries and raspberries.
So now are we ready to leave France and go to Italy?
Yeah. Well, you and I cannot get together without going to Italy. Okay, first of all, Moscato d'Asti. Okay, everyone has heard about this. Green apples in soft fizz. 11% alcohol. It'd be really hard to get tipsy on this one. And it's wonderful as a dessert wine instead of all the caloric stuff you could have. And it's also great with salty food. Lambrusco. Everybody goes, yuck, when you hear that. Just a minute here. This is not that syrupy sweet Ludens sparkling wine.
Cough syrups on fizz, yeah.
This is dry and crisp. And if you can imagine a dry strawberry, perfect for panini, sandwiches, picnics, and just a very unique taste, and just here in the U.S. Another one just arrived is sparkling Pinot Grigio. in this case, one that they meant to make sparkling. And what a different alternative to have with like a sautéed fish or a roasted chicken.
Every once in a while, we think of a celebrity who has like a signature drink. And I know you have a signature drink for Mr. Pavarotti that we lost this year.
Oh, yes. In honor of him, you should always buy at least one bottle of Bella Vista a year. Bella Vista is made from Chardonnay. It's made in Franciacorta, which is the sparkling wine area of Italy. And this is an unbelievably beautiful wine. And let that go down your throat and then let out an A.
Thank you so much, Stacey.
Thanks, Evan.
Stacey Hunt is a principal at Duvan Wine and Spirits, a great local wine resource on San Vicente near Melrose. I've got some of Stacey's suggestions at kcrw.com/goodfood. Now, of course, one of the great things about LA is that you can find authentic Thai food in corner mini malls all over Hollywood. I'll be right back with our Thai food ambassador, Jet Tila. He's got a great place for us to try. That's coming up next on Good Food. The lovely Jet Tila of All Things Thai here in Los Angeles is with me this morning, and he's going to take us to a new Thai place for us to experience.
It's kind of it's a hidden Thai place that's been around for a while, but it's a real true hole in the wall that seats about 15 people. So it's called Spicy Barbecue Restaurant, and it's in that little corridor of Normandy and Santa Monica in a real unassuming little strip mall. It's this really fantastic northern Thai woman, and my mom's from Chiang Mai, so this is all the food that she grew up with, and this is the food that's really hard to find. She has 11 items out of like 70 that's really northern Thai, so it's just really kind of out of the way, and no one really knows about it place until now.
I'm afraid now. She's going to be...
She's going to get killed.
She's going to get killed.
Yeah.
You're going to have to warn her. I think maybe you're going to have to put on an apron.
Yeah, it's four tables, and I think I'll be the second person in the kitchen because it's just her sitting there on her mortar and pestle.
Oh, that's
dressed
unbelievable.
Dressed in her northern gear every day because that's just how she dresses. It's really just really kind of spiritual experience because you feel like she's really about it and she loves what she does.
So let's talk about these 11 special dishes that are her true soul food.
When most people travel to Chiang Mai or Lampang area, they come back and there's this dish called khao soi. And on the menu, it literally says Northern Thai egg noodles. So you're thinking, is it a stir fry? Is it a soup? So it's basically a curry-based soup. But when I say curry, I don't want you to think overly kind of hot. These are all homemade curries that are pounded in the kitchen by her. So it's this bowl of like what would look like a warm curry soup with these really fantastic soft egg noodles, the semi-wide ones that you would get in a Hong Kong style noodle house that would be, you know, swimming in like stewed pork or stewed chicken. There's turmeric powder, and then there's eating turmeric, that really warm kind of spice of turmeric. That's the first thing that hits you.
So she uses fresh turmeric?
She uses fresh turmeric to pound out this paste. And then, of course, the garlic comes around, and then the chili comes around. And it's definitely protein heavy. I mean, you know, the northern folks, it's a hearty place. It's cold, so they eat a lot of protein to insulate themselves. And then, so there's a stewed, soft, falling apart beef in this stew of the curry and the noodles. And it's the dish you can't get anywhere, and it's the dish that people go to the north and eat and come back and go, where can I get khao soi? And this is the one place it has it, and it's really done well.
I am so hungry right now, and you just started.
I'm sorry. It's the first dish, I know. I'm only going to, like, highlight four or five.
Okay.
But despite its unsexy name, you know, larb, which we call lap in Thai, it's a minced pork, it's a minced beef. And then add to that, you know, roasted rice, which is basically like white rice that's roasted down, pounded kind of like a cornmeal texture, and then you add to that your lime and your fish sauce. So it's just really kind of hearty, like we would think of like chicken salad. It's got meat in it, but it's kind of a cold dish, right? So they do a northern larb, and I guess what's really different about her larb is it's not overly acidic. She makes her own little liver chips. So she takes liver And she must dry it or dehydrate it in the oven, slice it really thin, and then deep fry it. And pig ears for me are something nice, like crackling. So she takes these pig ears and she dries them out, and then she deep fries them. So in this larb is a really lean ground pork, is a hint of lime because it's not too acidic, some fish sauce. And then you get those really smoky spices because you can tell she takes those chilies and roasts them herself slowly. So you have this really overly smoky quality that's really nice. So larb is fantastic. And then we get into, you know, something I call numpik ong. This dish called numpik ong is basically like a dip. You know how we have chili dips in Thailand. Now, there's two primary ones in this restaurant. The first one is a ground pork and roasted tomato. And it has the consistency of like chili, what we think of as southern, you know, beef chili. And it comes with, you know, your cold vegetables, your cabbage and your cucumbers. And the next dip, what they call nempik num, which basically is, if you imagine the flavor of smoky tomatillo salsa, you know, that's kind of what it's like. They take eggplant, Thai eggplant and Asian eggplant, the long eggplants. They roast them until they're charred through, and then they smash them down into the roasted chilies, add a little lime juice, and then they serve that with kind of this boiled cabbage, like you're like an Irish boiled cabbage. So that's really amazing as well. I'm waiting for you to jump in here with me.
No, I mean, I'm mesmerized.
No. I guess the next dish I want to talk about is what they call a ganglé, and it's really a stew. I want you to think about a stew, a hearty, like an Irish stew for us. And now flip it and think about, there's three proteins. So she takes pork belly, she takes dark meat chicken, and she takes a stew beef. And she'll cook it down in another type of deep curry paste flavor. So it's almost vindaloo-ish in flavor because she has the modifier of tomato. You really taste this overwhelming tomato flavor like Indian curry gives you. So add to that like a Thai curry flavor, and then it's stewed down so it's nice and gelatinous and it's really deep. And you eat it with dabs of sticky rice because you don't need any other rice there.
And what's that called again?
I'm giving you the Thai names, but I really should kind of slow down and give you the American names. So that one is basically called Gang Hung Le, Northern Thai Curry. And the staples of Northern food, of course, are the sausages. I mean, the Northern people have their own line of charcuterie and preserving meats. So the Northern sausages are a hit. I got to say, this restaurant can be summed up in these four dishes. So if you go there, go to their Northern Thai cuisine section on the menu and weed through these really benign descriptions of their food and order it. I mean, it's really good stuff.
So once again, tell us the name of the restaurant and where it is.
Okay, so it's Spicy Barbecue Restaurant. And the actual address is 5101 Santa Monica Boulevard. And it's Santa Monica Boulevard that crosses Normandy. So it's kind of right south of Thai Town.
And let's have the caveat that this is an extremely tiny place. Don't everyone who's listening immediately turn your car there at once. Let's have you go in an orderly fashion over the next month. This has been so much fun. Thank you, Jet.
Well, I can't wait to eat there with you and run into our listeners there.
Find the address and location of the place Jet talked about at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can also find out about Jet Tila's cooking classes there, too. You can find info on today's show, watch the latest video cast, it's an easy and delicious mushroom soup, and hear past episodes online at kcrw.com/goodfood. You can write me at goodfood@kcrw.com. I love hearing from you. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show's produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Karen Soriano. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join me next week for another edition of Good Food.